This hearing of the House Judicial Council Committee will now come to order. It is 3:07 p.m. Thursday, March 12, 2020, in Davis, Vermont. Members present are Representative Jackson, Representative Quinlan, Representative Snow, Representative Carr, and myself, Representative Zelkowski, Chair. If the record reflects that we have a quorum to conduct business, please take the time to silence yourself for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank the Department of the House, as Recording Secretary, and Personal Administrator Ally for starting the committee today. Today we will have an initial hearing on our committee rule, House Bill 305, related to mandatory reporters of child abuse neglect. We will then begin consideration of the editor's appointees to mental health trust authority board of trustees, and the Alterman and Rhonda Broyles. And then the state medical board appointees, David Breslow, Dr. Richard Mean, and Dr. Steve Parker. I will take a brief eddy, so I think I will return to the panel to chair this meeting for the presentation of House Bill 305. I want to begin by thanking everyone for the opportunity to present House Bill 305, our committee bill to amend mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. We don't want this moment to pass without recognizing that today we celebrate the life and memory of Ashley Johnson Barr, and it feels very appropriate and timely for us to be considering this bill in committee today. I'd like to begin by talking briefly about the genesis of House Bill 305. As we all remember, on February 13th, our committee heard a 2020 update on child abuse and molestation from Pam Carolinas, Daniel Dewey, and Dr. Mike Hopper from the United Children's Justice Act Task Force. As we heard that day, the Children's Justice Act Task Force is federally mandated and funded. The task force works to identify areas where improvement is needed in a stable response to child maltreatment, particularly child abuse, and make recommendations for actions that we can take to improve the system. That day, members of the task force recommended several improvements we can consider in terms of addressing child abuse in Alaska. One of the recommendations focused on closing gaps in mandatory reporters or individuals who must report suspected cases of child abuse, which will offer earlier interventions that seek to protect Alaska's children. At the end of our meeting, there appeared to be broad consensus among all members of our committee to do something, to join the Children Justice Act Task Force in championing Alaska's children and families. That brings us to the draft House Bill you have before you today. The framework of House Bill 305 is aligned with the recommendations made to the committee in the February 13th hearing. Given the wide support among the committee, we felt that this was the best place to begin with this legislation. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present before the committee today. Katie will now walk us through a detailed review of the draft legislation, as well as opportunities that we believe that there are in improving this legislation moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Bosley. On the record, my name is Katie Dorman, staff to Representative Bosley. I'll walk you through the executive providing the presentation. So, Section 1 amends AS 2235, the backing of section. And what this section does ultimately is it requires a judge of the Superior Court or a district court, in the case that we believe that there is a imminent threat of harm to a child, by law enforcement at the time of issuing a domestic violence protective in and of itself may require law enforcement. But overall, there is a working group right now between the individuals, representatives from OCS, and law enforcement to really look at administrative fixes for this, this gap. And basically, setting up a series of red flags to object. Perhaps the perpetrator had mentioned things like weapons or specifically had swimming or not harming a person or a child. So, in the next iteration of this bill, we may be looking at removing Section 1. Moving on to Section 2. First of all, a little bit of a language cleanup. Currently, this is paraphrasing, but it says, prostitute in the performance of their occupational or employment duties, and reasonable cause to suspect that the child has suffered harm. Just clean up the language a little bit and say, in essence, a duty is associated with the position listed in this subject. The current list of mandatory reporters is listed here. You'll see, after practitioner of the human birth, which is secondary physicians, other medical providers, school teachers, police officers, etc. I won't run through the whole list for you. But the real meat of the legislation is adding additional categories of mandatory reporters, which are listed here. So we have members of the clergy, we have individuals who work in public and private animal shelters. There is very frequently overlap between people who will abuse an animal and a person who will abuse a child. We have first responders and also guardians at home for children. Representative Clayton brought to my attention that there is another place in statute where we have mandatory reporting for abuse of vulnerable adults or elder abuse. And I'm looking at the list of mandatory reporters between these two sets of statutes. There seems to be an opportunity to maybe bring into alignment definitions and have you'll see here I've sort of chosen some obvious, well, the obvious to me at least, areas of opportunity where maybe we can clean up the language in the list of mandatory reporters. So one example here is you'll see under vulnerable adults, we have number 6 police officers and 7 village public safety officers, which would put both along in the category of number 3 under the children's statutes of peace officers. And so I think there's opportunity there to maybe look at both sets of statutes in the next iteration of this bill to address the two statutes we need from bringing them into a manual of the other. So thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Recommended by the Children's Justice Act Task Force. Vulnerable adults, as you see on the left, members of the clergy are already included as mandatory reporters for vulnerable adults, but not left for children. So it does appear to be an opportunity for some alignment, as we were planning to bring both of them together, and we would be recommending at the end of, this presentation, we'll be recommending to be substituted for consideration.
Sure, and then Representative Pruitt, I think on the next slide, I do actually have a recommendation related to how we would list the category members of the clergy. One of the things I did in preparation for this is I looked through the statutes from every single state and whether they listed basically members of the clergy in their own statutes and saw a lot of variation in how it was defined. The way that our current HB 305 is drafted, which is priest ministers and other individuals who are ordained and roped and are appointed, to me felt a little bit too state of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, doesn't really matter. If you are serving in the capacity as clergy member for that religion, it's either being clergy in this category. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it because I think that's important that clergy has a specific connotation. But I think we have to be very careful in making sure that it is defined for what we need it to be. I mean, I think there are places in statute, and the courses may not necessarily connect to those, where an individual comes church as an example, can potentially make teachers be considered clergy for purposes of tax exemption status. So, there's some making sure that we clearly define it, and teachers are already covered. Some are already there. But I think my point is that I think this is really important piece to making sure that we find the right move. If it's an honor or a rabbi or someone, we want to make sure that it covers what we want. So I appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll continue to have some conversation on that. So thank you.
Another recommendation, and I've got to know a lot more related to suppliers talk more about this, but we would also add another animal shelter workers people working with veterinary clinics as well. But I think that will kind of decide more if any testifiers kind of a little bit more. And then also,
statutes that involve the before marriage in our state, we can address that question. So, there's this whole issue of internal consistency across different parts of our statutes alone. In different branches of the other 50 states, that they realize that there's some merit in trying to be consistent with these so that it doesn't include it in the language in which it's replaced. But the part about that really hard to think is also sort of clouds of experience as practitioners in the UNRs. Physicians and licensed healthcare providers, whatever, and mental health professionals, is not part of the human rights. The social work is part of the human rights. Village health is part of the human rights. So there's a lot of inconsistencies that back and forth that need to be made through in the council. There's a lot of people who are inconsistent in this trial. And the other thing I would just note in terms of how you measure it, which I'm curious, if I'm not curious, you're just curious. Maybe not measuring items in the P and P. I took the bank of just a couple of weekends ago, and I had a full year old from that before I got the bank of the shots. And I'm saying if we're talking about having measuring items as opposed to shelter workers, we ought to make some effort to get some communications with the veterinarians before we go down that path because they certainly make sense with it.
And I think it is, this is a starting point for me types of other issues they raise with, you know, what kind of employment now. Are these people who volunteer a few hours a week at an animal shelter, are they going to receive training on this if they're going to be counseling for reporters on child abuse? So we have, training mandated and it's actually for the insurance funds that they have to be trained on this. So it's a starting point, and I very much believe in stakeholder engagement, and so that's something that I'm going to be moving forward really hard on to make sure that as we roll out, these mandatory rules, coverage and mandatory reporters, that these groups feel like they've been engaging and considered their time to do moving forward. I'll also just go back on this comparison of the statute to it. I did include a full list, and I'm looking at that under crappy in there. This is just, it's a little similar to the whole section, but you'll see there's a lot of crossover and a lot of places for opportunity to amend these definitions and categories and put some alignment up there. We have a legal one that actually that list of all the partners that fit into practitioners and seminars, but includes things like physicians, medical examiners. It's sort of a vague term, and I don't love it. And so I feel like that's sort of a really good one to maybe start with. Kind of find what that is, so someone who's reading the statute would have sort of a better sense of what that is.
At the beginning, when I read practitioners in the healing arts, I will just confess I didn't think necessarily about licensed healthcare providers as being practitioners in the healing arts, although I can see how it could be a term, but it seems to me that we could probably use a little bit more specificity rather than
Thank you. Thank you.
testimony, but I also want to make sure time for other people.
Gary's, I was, I took the time when you made reference to MS 4717-29, subsection 14 of that practice for the healing arts, and I was curious what was next, and I was surprised by the wide coverage that's in that definition. But I didn't specifically look for paramedics, so I didn't find it in there. And is paramedics listed somewhere else, or did I just misread the structure, or did you perhaps misread the structure? I'm just looking at the list, and it's quite extensive. It includes athletic trainers and naturopaths. It includes hearing aid dealers licensed under the appropriate statute, marriage and family therapists, religious healing practitioners, acupuncturists, health aides, which is fairly comprehensive, but by paramedic communities. But again, you know, you can answer that question specifically. I think we can look at that differently. I would just also make interesting that if the genesis of this representative trial had both received an APC email some time in December from I believe an Episcopal religious figure in Wisconsin who noted the fact that we had a mandatory reporting for vulnerable Hispanic clergy, but not for children, and that's where this whole discussion started. And so I think the genesis is totally consistent with your observations and why it's so important to have clergy listening to it. I think we're sold on the importance.
Between government,
Size things, we have a whole size drive that we hand out to folks so that they can put it in any
terms of making the decision to participate in the camp that you've completed the training, how we would correct others or the message and government forces, mandatory reporters, requiring, you know, that you improve who attended the training. And I just, it's really, I worked in other states and I'm just kind of making a decision. We go into them for some things that are actually much going to be dicey. And I have to take a lot of the lawyers and go down in the aisle, so just as a side note.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for telling me this is an important piece of the overall conversation. So right now, if you are in these categories, but that currently exists, you might take the training, but some other force to take the training. But is it seems to me that the liability would be on you if you don't spot something bad or poorly? I mean, is it? I mean, how does it currently work in terms of how the reporting goes now? I mean, I get the concept, right? There's the concept of we want to manage the report. But the actual being the person that's actually in that situation having to see these different perspectives, what is the burden on them to have the knowledge to spot things in the mandatory implications that if they were to miss something, because that is not always black and white, what are the ramifications on them there if they don't address this issue?
So there's the food chair, which is moved right, and I'm a loyal lawyer, I'm a legal lawyer. So in terms of the, I'm not actually very familiar with its problem with criminal statute in terms of, you know, there are any ramifications for not reporting when you're in the as you hear with that kind of statute. So, from what I remember, I took more than 90% of reporting for mandatory reporters to kind of look at, so, what would be, you know, the consequence for not reporting on these pieces of business? Is it something like you go to jail? Well, if I'm a volunteer in school for a few hours and, you know, I suspect you of this, but I'm really not sure, and even though I have this moment at school, I don't have too much experience, so I say not to. But I can say if a child was being abused and you didn't report it, you're going to learn from that. You know, is that the right kind of advice for someone in my position? So there is, you know, some amount of government work around the social media, kind of quarantine and quality or anything for mandatory reporters. But I mean, that's those are sort of the issues that come up when we're talking about enforcement for mandatory reporters and, you know, how, like, what would be appropriate for that kind of stuff.
I think it might be important thing here is where we love to think about the learning stuff. And if I compare people to the learning stuff, and we absolutely want to make sure that there's no way that you can argue that you can hide something or but it's that you're hitting on the people that we want to make sure that we're talking about the people that aren't don't see this every day and they might miss something because they don't see it. And how do we deal with that? We don't want to penalize someone. We don't want to penalize wrong people. We want to penalize wrong people, I guess, is the best way for not doing this. So we're here to speak. I usually, that's the new essence that we have to share with
them. I'm saying drops in the term. Thank you for the chair. Just speaking on the, this bill is a good starting point. Because right now, whoever's not listed to report, they know they are not listed to report. This is opening up and letting them know you are now responsible for reporting. The accountability, like you're saying, like we can't, if we try to get in the woods of that as legislators, that can really blow out of proportion what we're trying to do, which is bringing that awareness. So if I'm a clergy or in an area that I know I'm exempt, but now they know I'm not, that's on my conscience, right? But where I see accountability coming in is that is a problem. And they try to think that they're doing it to such and such. And that accountability and that this is law, it was written, it would give the families an opportunity for civil cases or whatever, you know, criminal. We just have to be careful of how we do this. But I believe this bill is bringing the awareness that those that have been exempt are no longer exempt. And no one's going to like that, you know, that your neighborhoods are cruel to you. But the point is, we have to start somewhere, and this is a big step. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Senator.
Yeah, I'm just going to check in with them because this is kind of also with the issue related to the volunteers in the school. So, perhaps any of them getting contact information out. I don't know if I have anybody from Rush Legal. It looks like for our last person, in terms of if you are a legal child reporter, a person who stands to comply with the law is requiring reports of child abuse or neglect or child pornography. If you knew or should have known that the circumstances give us a need for the court is guilty of a crime claim misdemeanor. And so, but you have to knowingly and willingly. So those are pretty high standards, and under those circumstances, you would probably have physical signs and things that would make it pretty indisputable that the child was in harm's way. And so that, to the extent that that holds an issue for folks, because I don't think the goal here, in there are different sections of statutes, but it's just more eyes to keep kids safe, not really about trying to drill people into their roles for not reporting. So, I think both of those would be the relevant statutes for that. And then, at least as I've learned through other bills, they don't believe this includes a civil penalty, because generally that would be included in the legislation. Right? So, failure to report can have a fine of some kind or some kind of civil penalty, but that's not here. So, it seems like we're not undue responsibilities to people that would. You know, put them in a position where they, they're involved in trouble, but more practical. And I guess it brings me back to that other point, because it would come up that, from the expectation of attending like a 1 hour training, that seems like a very reasonable ask, and I will be, again, trying to sort of maybe see if there's a way with your guidance and suggestions on that, that'd be great. But, just add a little bit of clarity about that, so we're sort of separating, expectations between this versus, someone who, for example, is a teacher and sees a kid every day and never reports anything, even though there's obvious harm, then you do have a statute to address a case like that.
As my friend was referring to, there are some updates that you made to the training, the change before you went from last year that was passed. That's we changed a little bit to it. Part of what each before they had done it was amended to take it out. That was requiring annual mandatory training of report training. And, while that could potentially be considered a new burden and some things, but for the person who's volunteering who's experienced, having that every year, that's a reinforcement, maybe a good positive way instead of a negative reinforcement. So, just wanted to say that we eliminated the requirement of the training to gain on the training. It's not an annual requirement.
Thank you.
So, this has been a very interesting conversation. I think we have moved forward the discussion and our shared knowledge about this topic. I want to give Representatives of SBA a chance to make some closing comments today, and then move on. We have referees or, appointees that have been waiting for confirmation and discussion with us, and we make sure we get to them. So, Chair Zucker.
Thank you, Representative Sondland. Again, I want to thank the committee members for your indulgence in working with our office as we drafted the legislation that we heard today. Emphasize that the intention of the initial draft getting back to conversation towards the end of our hearing today, we really intended for this to be a narrow fix that looks to bridge and close some of the reporting gaps that Alexandria Boxton had mentioned. And to Representative Carr's point, to really ensure that we're getting our eyes out there in community to ensure that children have that place. I do just want to throw that, I think it is an issue still from the reminder that this bill will move on to adjudication and once we've done it, we're advocating some of it in our community as well. And I assume that that community will also get into the weeds on the potential and also on our issues. But really, this was intended to be a starting point to really close the gaps because there was already such common ground on moving forward. So, as we move forward, our office will continue to stand up to everyone on what we can include in some avenues of technique and continue to bring forward the work resulting from all these conversations.
I think I can speak for the rest of us in terms of appreciation to you and your staff for doing the work on this and bringing this forward. And it's a rare moment when we need to bring Zucchini and May on an issue, and we've been reducing child abuse and neglect in this year. The last day is certainly one of those things that we can universally gather around. And it's particularly fitting that we're having this conversation on issue of our children today. We also have an audience in the room today, an intern in my office who is service-facing for us here in Alaska, who has been working with Leukemia and is very appreciative as well. So with that, we're going to take a brief break to help share good feedback further.
I will break the call this meeting back to order. We will now turn to the consideration of the Governor's Committee for Mental Health Trust and the Board of Trustees. First up, we have Anila Alterman. Ms. Alterman, if you could begin by introducing yourself for the record, and please give us a brief introductory statement on why you are interested in serving on the Board of Trustees.
Thank you. question for our planning files.
Hi, Ms. Gentleman. I am excited to see your name come forward. As the Mental Health Trust Authority, you've been a leader in many areas of our community. Especially on the co-op, which is how I think I know each of the most, but there's been a series of issues that have been highlighted over the last couple of years that have really illustrated how our mental health care system is failing to meet the needs of Alaskans experience that serious mental health issues. We have all of the challenges that APIV that have resulted in not being safe and therapeutic decision and lack of community-based support to care all of these sort of mental health, which have led to lawsuits and worse decision and more. What do you think that the trust should be doing to address those significant gaps?
Thank you, Dr. Chair. Knowing your dedication and loyalty to the community, to me, to have someone appointed to the Mental Health Trustee Authority is a very, very important and serious commitment to make. I thank you for willing to do this. And my question is, we just went through an appointment process in January last year, February maybe. And I just would like to know, if you receive this appointment, do you intend on staying with it? Because this isn't an easy thing to replace. And it would be nice to know that there's a longevity where you can help implement the differences that we know we need made. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Alterman, for your time with us today. Next up, we have Rhonda Boyles. Ms. Boyles, please introduce yourself for the record and give us a brief introductory statement on why you're interested in doing on the Board of Trustees.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be at a quick hand for a moment. Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from any members or Senator Cleveland has a question?
You kind of alluded to it just a minute ago, Ms. Boyles. It sounds like you were appointed a few months ago and you attended the first meeting after your appointment. You were then awaiting confirmation or did you attend before you made your appointment? Shy away from the offering to serve in this position. As I heard you had a place in Edmonton, is your actual official residency still Fairbanks? Phoenix, I take it, does not give you ever getting back for board meetings. I understand that. Thank you very much, and I thank you for to serve, and I appreciate the fact that you're taking the obligation with the seriousness that you already have, and I also appreciate the fact that you realize that a little sunshine is probably good for your mental health.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Stoltz?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Boyles, for your interest in public service. It sounds to me like you've done a lot of political work, you've done a lot of business or business experience and land management. But what the question more does is really about focusing on the beneficiaries and identifying ways that the trust can maximize its resources for the benefit of beneficiaries. There was some confusion on the part of some previous board members about what the role of the board was, which then led to a website audit that was done a few years back, and has led to some major some changes in the way that the trust is doing business. The trust board members were spending more time on
resource development than there were, I think, meaning the needs of the beneficiaries that was their primary objective. Have you read that report and considered that as your understanding your role for on the trust board? As I alluded to in my questions to Ms. Halperin earlier, we have not been meeting the needs of our beneficiaries in the state of Alaska. And there was some work that was done in the 90s to sort of reimagine what our mental health care system should look like in the state of Alaska that included downsizing EPI and the vision for expanding community-based services. And we downsized EPI, but we never dramatically expanded community-based services to meet the needs of folks. And we now are in 2020, and it's been at least 25 years since some of those decisions were made, and we haven't realized the vision there. And it's going to require a lot of concerted leadership in this area to resolve all of the issues that I've identified. I met Morse finding, Dr. Morse's finding recently, in the system staff are wondering, how you plan to approach that big, important work.
I didn't see the first of Sunday.
one of the first things to come out right aloud. The added clue of science that if the trust would like to do those things, then it should request statutory authority to do that, and both the support that they have back operating outside of the scope of its authority to do so. And I guess, I'm glad to hear that you've been having conversations and that you're moving forward into sort of understanding the scope of issues. We certainly have a crisis, and I think that, the trust board, if it's been to focus all of its time and energy on serving beneficiaries right now, I think that we could potentially really move the needle into our core in terms of our whole system. It's going to require everybody to focus on that. Perhaps we could leave the land element and investing in the professionals whose job it is to do that. Thank you.
Encourage you to learn, and you can contact the Mental Health Trust staff and give you directions and probably help arrange it for you. But you're interested in mental health treatment, and you talk with somebody in clinics about different options for treatment. The Mental Health Trust has actually brought several people to a crisis intervention center in Phoenix in the suburb of Peoria, which I suspect you know where it is in Phoenix. And I think I can probably remind you that a tour of the crisis intervention center is actually a pretty important issue for the trustees. And they haven't discussed it, they might need to attend it. But arranging to get a tour of the crisis intervention center, I think, would actually give you further insight into some of the issues the trust is working on. And I would encourage you to communicate with case staff and see if they can arrange a visit. I was in Phoenix a few months ago, and they were able to help get a visit from me arranged, so I suspect they can. Even better for you, and I would strongly encourage you to follow up on that.
Thank you, Ms. Bowles, for your time with the committee today. I will now open public testimony on the Mental Health Trust Authority appointees. In the interest of time left in committee and the additional individuals that are on the line for their hearings as well, I will be limiting public testimony to 2 minutes per person. So I'd like to begin. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I will go online. We have Charles McKee. Are you on the line? Mr. Ricky, this is your opportunity for public testimony and to not ask questions of the appointees. So if you can wrap up your public testimony.
Thank you. Commissioner McKee, can you wrap up your bill of testimony?
Understand. Thank you.
And to the testifying for the committee today. Seeing no additional individuals wishing to testify, I'd like to close public testimony. We will now turn to the consideration of the governor's appointees to the state medical board. First up, we have David Boswell. Mr. Boswell, please introduce yourself for the record and begin by giving us a brief introductory statement on why you are interested in serving on the state medical board.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Boswell, and so I want to begin by thanking you all for taking the time to be with me today. I'm happy to spend this Boswell in the last 10 minutes of the working in the Fairbanks community with the Rhode Island Church of Christ for the past 15 years. I've been an active member of the community, and I have 8 children, both of whom are adopted right here in the state of Alaska out of the foster care program. We have 9 foster children over the years, and we adopted 4 of them. I currently have 7 sons and 1 daughter. My oldest is married and is now to over 38, but the rest of all of them live here in Fairbanks in their home. I have 2 sons who are full-time students at the University of Alaska here in Fairbanks, and I'm a member of the Lighthouse Union Open Grant Program. My daughter and her younger sons are currently full-time from Michigan here in Fairbanks. We are an active family. I have been actively involved in the music community here in Fairbanks. Each of my children have been trained through the Suzuki program, as well as participated in the Fairbanks Youth Symphony, potentially graduating my oldest at home within the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra. I have spent a lot of time volunteering in the community. I volunteered at the hospital at the end of the valley here several years ago. I am very familiar, and I make regular visits to the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, as well as the Benelli Center and the Pioneer Home for Rhode Island Youth. I also currently serve as a member of the Governor's Council for Disability and Special Education. I have only been interested in the medical field and have lost my interest in becoming a sports medicine physician before I was called into a transplant area to younger men. I have completed 3 years of genetics and biochemistry at the University of Alberta in Canada, where I grew up. Even though I eventually got a degree in theology, I feel that years prepared me to never undertake the tasks that the job was going to entail. I love the community here in Alaska. I feel very blessed to be able to raise my family here. I have benefited greatly from the community and seek to give back to the community in meaningful ways, which I believe this forum will allow me to do. I do recognize the importance of this job, and I'm committed to fulfilling to the best of my ability as an opportunity to serve this community that I love. My life has been dedicated to serving within my church and knowing people from this community, and this task of serving the people of the state. I want to thank you so much for considering me today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have for me.
Thank you, Mr. Boswell. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Clement?
Thank you, Mr. Boswell. I have a couple of questions. If you could comment a little bit more about the work you're doing with one of the hospitals now.
Certainly, in my role as a minister, much of the time that I spend in the hospitals is doing either with those that are in their long-term or emergent situations. Most of the time I spend with helping the patients that partner not too much with the physicians or attendants in the family, and I am often present when they are coming in on their rounds or doing.
Are these folks that are actually members of your church, or are you performing some kind of pastoral, volunteer pastoral duties in the hospital for people that are actually missing the number of clergy and you're happy to see them?
For the chair, I am. The majority of the people that I am members of are active members of my congregation or have been members of the community who have requested me to come in, although I do on a regular basis also have them there, see others, and encourage them.
So one of the things that I think cases that may come before the medical board, and it relates to decisions that the Alaska Supreme Court has made about medical care and required medical care that is to be provided. And one question I have, how would you approach your duty on the medical board if you may have personal views that disagree with decisions of the Alaska Supreme Court? Would you be able to nevertheless serve on the medical board in a way that and offer opinions consistent with the way the Alaska Supreme Court has issued decisions addressing medical treatment?
I would consider myself a pretty strong-minded individual, and I certainly want to uphold the law in every way possible. I've been trained in ethics as well, and so I definitely feel like I could not consider everything out there and whether I can stay in the law to the best of my ability.
So I'll make my question a little bit more pointed. The Alaska Supreme Court has issued a decision about abortion rights and the provision of abortions by physicians in Alaska. That bound other individuals that don't agree with that decision of the Alaska Supreme Court. And so my particular question to you is, to the extent you may personally disagree with that decision of the Alaska Supreme Court, will you be able to serve on this board and make votes that recognize that decision of the Supreme Court and the need for the medical board to make decisions that don't conflict with the existing decisions of the Supreme Court?
Yes, I believe I can.
Thank you.
Ms. Hanson-Bowles?
Thank you, Mr. Riswell. You described your work and your service to the community. That's very kind of like to was a foster parent and adoptive parent. And from the work of the Salvation Army, you described a broad range of experience, none of which I think have really a lot to do with sort of the issues of licensure and the practice of medicine. And I'm wondering what motivated your interest in serving on the state medical board, given this really very technical work that is done by the state medical board.
Sure. As I was considering the interest that I have, I certainly have always been interested in medicine. And I know that I began my education in the direction. It was just an opportunity as I looked at that there was a number of physicians in the past 10 years, particularly focused on the four children that we have.
Mr. Boswell, the state medical board has statewide reach, of course, with statute that has indicated an intent to send members from as many geographic areas as possible. Can you discuss your familiarity with rural communities off Alaska's roads with still your experience in traveling throughout the state? Question, can you discuss your knowledge and familiarity with healthcare and a variety of health institutions that provide care throughout rural Alaska in particular?
understanding the conditions that may be needed within those systems or from the Alaska Thread system. By serving on the state medical board as the public member. So I'm really hearing where you're getting that when you say that you're encouraging people to be represented. The state medical board's function is to ensure that medical providers in the state of Alaska are meeting licensure requirements and that they're practicing medicine within the scope of their training and the bounds of the law. That is the role of the state medical board. Is not being represented in the execution of that duty.
Just in the past several months, I have had
courage to think that, you know, these conversations are really sufficient to have a deep understanding of what's happening in the healthcare community. I mean, this is the kind of profession where people have decades of experience and still feel like they've just scratched the surface of understanding their profession and sort of the, you know, professional needs of their colleagues. And I don't really dispute that you have an interest in these issues. I'm not sure that interest is strong enough for me to think, even as the public member, that you would be a good person. Our healthcare system, as we're seeing right now with the COVID situation, is very fragile, and it would concern me to not have a deeper experience in some form of healthcare delivery, whether it be administrative or something more directly related. So that's a concern I have.
For physicians and different types of providers, what experience or qualifications
full opportunity for this work?
Thank you, Mr. Osmond, for your time today. It appears that those are all the questions. Representative Dorr?
Thank you. I just was hoping Mr. Osmond could clarify, how long have you been serving on the Governor's Council?
Last year. This year, I was still
on the Governor's Council. Just last year, you were in the office of 2019. Okay, so about 6 months.
Any other questions at this time? Thank you, Mr. Boswell, for your interest in this board and your time with us today. I do want to thank both Dr. Richard Ween and Dr. Steve Parker, who've been on the line. Unfortunately, we've run out of committee time so far today. We will work with both of you to get you rescheduled your statements as well as questions from the committee. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be on Tuesday, March 17th at 3 p.m. here in Davis Room 106. We will be continuing consideration of the governor's appointees to the state medical board. We have also noticed initial hearings for House Bill 267 by myself, Representative Zelkowski, related to short-term health care insurance, and also House Bill 255 by Representative Joseph Sillian on waivers on work requirements for the food stamp program. The time is 4:58 p.m. and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.